are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, May 2nd, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Ben Burgess, he teaches logic and philosophy at Rutgers University, and he's author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. We take leave of our feelings, because we're always in our feelings as leftists, we're always in our bags, to talk about facts and logic in the cause of socialism with the great Ben Burgess. Excellent new book, which you can pre-order from Zero Books. The U.S. military is on the balls of its feet footing with regards to Venezuela. This is extremely disturbing. Juan Guaido is saying he needs more military pressure to effectively mount a coup in Venezuela. Donald Trump and other administration officials continue to make threats against the Venezuelan government. William Barr is not going to go speak to the House Judiciary Committee after Kamala Harris washes him in the Senate Judiciary Committee hearings. Moderate Democrats fret about their vote for Bill Barr because apparently it's just too naked for them.
They should be fretting about a lot more than
that. Yeah, I would say if you're Joe Manchin, you should be fretting about your basically the entirety of your public career, as well as your daughter's private career. Look up that career. Emails show that the Trump administration had no way of linking separated, kidnapped children from their relinking them with their parents after they had been kidnapped, and that there are dozens that have still not been reunited after the terrorist policy of kidnappings. A 16-year-old boy, migrant, has died in U.S. government custody in Texas. And a Newton judge is to return to court on May 30th on charges of helping immigrants elude an ICE officer. So facing criminal consequences for doing the right and basic human thing. The Trump administration is bringing McKinsey on to check out the student loan system. And we can already tell you what the one, I would assume many, but the one certainty of a continued policy if Pete Buttigieg is elected president. Christian Gillibrand has a plan to give every voter $600 to donate to campaigns in a yawn fest. Sorry. I would focus more on the getting them health care versus getting them currency to give campaigns.
I want but
here's money.
Bucks.
Yeah. Here's gift cards you can exclusively spend on our campaigns.
Right. How about a gift card you could exclusively spend on, I don't know, your house or your health care? Beto O'Rourke says he won't take fossil fuel money, but he already has. There is a second, boring as all anything, Colorado Democrat who's running for president. I refuse to even say his name. Hickenlooper at least had an entertainment value. You can look it up. Jeffrey Sachs says that U.S. sanctions have devastated Venezuela. Lula da Silva says Brazil is run by lunatics. And that and much more on today's Majority Report. We're all here. Sans Sam. How's everybody doing?
Well.
Matt as well. Jamie, how are you?
I'm all right today. Pretty good.
Brendan?
I'm feeling more powerful as the white centrist hydra of 2020 Democratic candidates grows.
I understand that, like, I get Sam's perspective, and I think it's right that, like, if everybody's running, it's less humiliating to lose. But I have to start thinking that, like, when Seth Moulton starts in that, like, I don't know. Like,
Eric Swalwell.
Eric Swalwell. Like, doesn't it just at a certain point become, like,
Tim Ryan?
You know, this is kind of embarrassing.
You know, like the 21st person to hop on should feel a little bit embarrassed.
It's like, guys, sorry. Like, Joe Biden. Like, sorry. He's got that lane, guys.
It's so redundant.
And he's definitely a better politician.
Well, I think the other thing I'm keeping an eye on is the Democrats that are running for president when they should just run for Senate in their home state. There's a guy, Steve Bullock in Montana, who's looking like he's going to run for president. Beto O'Rourke, of course.
Beto O'Rourke prime should run for Senate.
Yeah. Like, I'm tired of, like, and it's like that class of Democrat that's telling us we need to be very serious about the Senate, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, glass houses. Oh, why would I take a Senate seat back from a Republican when I could run for president and lose miserably?
It's I want to do one honorable exception of these candidates, and I do think Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington, who's governing, who is polling at, I saw a poll from New Hampshire where he was one, I think there was maybe one other person, maybe like Julian Castro or some other, you know, someone like that who deserves no respect, who literally no person said they were voting for. Like, his zero was like zero, like 0.0. But Jay Inslee is the governor of Washington, and his campaign is totally climate-centric. So I want to give, like, honorable mention to Jay Inslee so far of these. Like, he's the only one that I can see where it's like, oh, there's an actual justifiable distinct lane. But we can add, like, the Bennett, Hickenlooper, Ryan. And
those
I refuse.
Are all the same guy. Like, they're literally so redundant.
Yes.
Yeah, they're Hydra.
They're the same.
Like,
they're
I refuse to learn the difference between these people because there is not one.
Yeah, I was going to say, what would you learn?
Their names,
I mean,
I guess.
Seth Moulton, I guess, has like a all right mass accent, but I've never even heard him talk, so I'm just assuming that. And Swalwell's, you know, very, like, energetic. Swalwell's, like, way less cool than those Krasenstein brothers. And he reminds me of them, but I have a lot more respect for the Krasensteins.
The Krasensteins would pull better than he would.
No doubt. All right. Speaking of people whose contribution to public... Well, we just talked about negligible contributions to public life. Let's go to someone whose overall impact in public life might be unintentionally positive, because by how absolutely, stunningly, relentlessly horrible she is, she's both good for us in terms of the analytics and numbers, and is a literal walking, living, breathing case study against all forms of inherited dynastic power. Of course, I'm talking about Meghan McCain and Bernie Sanders, as he continues to do. Look, we know that he's the leader on inequality, on healthcare, on justice, when no one else was talking about these issues, when actually people were fighting for the other side of these issues, like Joe Biden. But now we're going to have to acknowledge that he's a leader on foreign policy. The Yemen resolution is actually historically groundbreaking. The Trump administration continues to support a genocidal campaign there. His leadership's been massive in that regard. And I would actually say asserting the right of universal suffrage is a radical, absolutely necessary, politically extremely risky, and, you know, cynics and cornballs like Cory Booker will take shots at him for it. But it's a brave, brilliant stance that every single person in this country, even if they are in prison, should have a right to vote. So props, as always, to Bernie Sanders. And Meghan McCain is not happy.
No, you should not get out.
But I think he should be given the death penalty. I mean, that's where I'm at with this. People who commit acts of terror on American soil.
Does this include, in your mind, domestic terrorists? Also?
Yes, terrorism is terror. Yes, of course.
And what about those guys who shoot schools up?
They should, of course, be in jail.
Child molesters.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to tell you, what Bernie Sanders said is going to be turned into a clip that will be. It upset me this morning.
How do you feel about the fact that people in Vermont are allowed to vote?
And I didn't have brothers that served multiple times, and I didn't watch my brother deploy when he was 19 to fight this crap, to have them come here and give the right to vote.
Can we all do an eye roll contest? This is mine. That's just like an assault of just like there's something about there's very, you know, weirdly, she reminds me of Thomas Friedman in a sense that it's both just like this aggressive stupidity. Like, it's like, it's not just that I'm really, really, really stupid. It's that I'm like that's what a Thomas Friedman column is like. It's just like, oh, my God. God, I have a bad take and a bad take and a bad take and boom, boom, boom.
It's like Thomas Friedman goes to the mall.
And did you see that? It's exactly, except he did. The real one did too. But, and did you notice how, I always forget her name, the good person that's
Sunny?
Next to me. Yeah, Sunny. You notice how Sunny's trying to point out that, like, this actual, this happens in Vermont, like, the policy dimensions of it, and she's just like, my brother. She's, like, bulldozing over, like, the actual point of the conversation. So I guess you got to give her some props to mention her brother instead of her dad.
Yeah, it's good to mix it up a little sometimes.
Yeah, mix it up.
She should just keep talking always. I think she's socialism's best advertisement.
I could not agree more.
She definitely makes our jobs easier.
Yeah, she makes our jobs easier. And I think at the end of the day, if you want to know why we need a Sanders presidency and some fundamental structural change, just watch a couple of clips of Meghan McCain. Because no decent society would allow that to exist. I mean, in a good society with tax inherited wealth, maybe Meghan McCain might have had to, like, you know, I don't know, work some, like, actual regular jobs and, like, learn to be, like, a decent human being.
And the way she says, you know, this is going to get clipped. Guess what, Meghan, as somebody who clips these sorts of things for propaganda purposes, be my guest. Yes. Go ahead and clip it.
Yeah. Go ahead, clip away. You know what else is going to get clipped? You. That's what also is getting clipped on a daily basis while you say these relentlessly nonsense takes.
Maoist Bernie.
Protect your loved ones with the peace of mind of life insurance. You think you can't afford it? Chances are SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. SelectQuote comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, Mutual of Omaha, and others, to find you a company with the best rates. For example, SelectQuote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. That's less than a dollar a day. A cup of coffee a day costs more than that. SelectQuote's breakthrough terminology allows them to quickly match you with the best insurance company to match your policy. Plus, quotes are free. SelectQuote could save you time and money. Get your free quote at selectquote.com/majority. That's selectquote.com/majority for your free quote. Don't put off protecting your family another day. SelectQuote.com/majority. Get full details on the example policy at selectquote.com/commercials. Your premium could vary depending on your health, issuing company, and other factors not available in all states. How did we find Brendan for this job? How did we discover Brendan?
Crystal ball.
Was it, well, oh, Crystal, you know, you work with Crystal Ball?
Yeah.
No, I didn't know that.
I thought that he was left on Sam's doorstep by a mysterious like witch.
He was like a little Irish president. He's just like, I could do a video clipping, sir.
Sam's like, hello?
Wait, so if I give you two potatoes a day and milk, you'll clip the videos that Michael and Matt won't do because they don't work hard enough. John Stewart jumping into a cab, rushing the scene. I was abandoned by my previous patron. I'll watch 10 hours of cable a day, sir, if you could just give me upkeep. It's actually a great character.
He like lives under Sam's stairs.
The Dickensian Majority Report.
It's just like, Mr. Cedar was a good master, an unrelenting one. However, he gave me roles when... that's a better use of the Jordan Peterson voice. No, of course, in reality, Brendan was discovered by Zip Recruiter. We all know that finding the right people is incredibly hard, and then managing the volume of applications, I'm starting to experience this myself. And it's very hard to keep track of the specific skill sets you need, but also obviously things like culture fit. But there's a place you can go where hiring is simple, fast, and smart, a place where growing businesses connect to qualified candidates, and that place is ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter sends your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards, but they don't stop there. With their powerful matching technology, ZipRecruiter scans thousands of resumes to find the right people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job. As applications come in, ZipRecruiter analyzes each one and spotlights the top candidates so you never miss a great match. ZipRecruiter is so effective that 4 out of 5 employees who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidates through the site within the first day. And right now, our listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. MAJORITY. ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. And we also got to talk to you about DoorDash. Long day at work, tough day at school, still stuck at the office. Treat yourself to a meal you deserve on demand from your favorite restaurant with DoorDash. DoorDash connects you to all your favorite restaurants in your city. Just use the DoorDash app to choose what you want to eat, and your Dasher will bring it right to you wherever you are with over 310,000 amazing restaurants. That's a huge amount. And over 3,300 cities across the U.S. and Canada, DoorDash lets you order from your local go-tos as well as favorite chains like Chipotle's, Wendy's, Chick-fil-A, and Cheesecake Factory. Let dinner come to you with DoorDash. Right now, our listeners can get $5 off their first order of $15 or more when you download the DoorDash app and enter promo code Majority Report. That's $5 off of your first order when you download the DoorDash app from the App Store and enter promo code Majority Report. Again, that's promo code Majority Report for $5 off of your first order from DoorDash. We're going to take a brief break, and we're going to come back with Ben Burgess, author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left.
Infrastructure, no bumps in the road. And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
This is Beanbag.
Hello.
Good morning, Patriots. Good morning, Rebels.
We came out of the Mar-a-Lago summit with very high hopes.
And they ended up finding themselves in this whole irony, and but you know, right, it's just kind of amusing.
Please don't try to talk over me, which is what liberals do.
And what is Aleppo?
I feel proud of myself about that.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. Joining us now is Ben Burgess. He's author of Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left, available for pre-order. It's published by Zero Books. He also teaches philosophy and logic at Rutgers University. He can be seen regularly on the Zero Books channel, a YouTube channel, doing logical deconstruction of right-wing arguments. You can also hear him on many different podcasts, including in a weekly segment on TMBS called The Debunk, which you can find on that YouTube channel as well. Ben, thanks so much for doing this. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Doing well. Make sure that when I talk, there isn't a little bit of an echo. I think it should be fine, though, but just make sure. So, Ben, let's start by setting the parameters of this book. I guess, you know, if you're like me, and I think us generally here, I guess as much as I hate to admit it, we probably do use logic and facts in our argumentation. But we also have been so put off.
Brave of you to admit that.
Yeah, it doesn't feel good to admit, but I guess it's true. But there's also the fact that these words, and probably a lot of words that are actually, you know, signify pretty good things, like, I don't know, or phrases like freedom of speech or...
Sure.
God forbid, even like open exchange of ideas. These are actually very defensible concepts in not just a liberal sense, in a socialist sense, in a very broad. I mean, if you read Amartya Sen, he wrote a great book called The Argumentative Indian. I mean, these are tools that you could find literally in any culture on earth for, you know, basically human communication and sort of figuring things out. They have been totally toxified by the sort of modern internet right wing. Obviously, most famously figures around the IDW and, you know, propaganda figures like Ben Shapiro. How did these words become toxified in popular discourse? And what do you mean when you use, well, not only when you use this, but when you actually teach it? I mean, you teach it professionally.
Yeah, so I think one of the big villains there, you know, long before the IDW, was Ayn Rand, who made a really big deal about logic all the time. Although, for example, in her book Atlas Shrugged, the sections of the book are named after these basic logical principles, like the law of non-contradiction. And there's always this vague implication that if you like understood enough about logic or you cared enough about logic, you would agree with Ayn Rand about, you know, capitalism and why socialism is bad and why altruism is bad and all those things. Even though there's really no connection whatsoever, which is also something that carries forward to the guys you're talking about, like IDW figures like Ben Shapiro, who makes a big deal about logic. The New York Times famously called him the destroyer of weak arguments.
How did that make through a copy edit? Sorry, tangent. Go ahead. The destroyer of weak arguments? That would definitely have gotten a red circle in an undergraduate paper.
It would. And one of the things that somebody like me would write in the margins is, if you're going to make this claim, I'd really like to see some examples.
Right.
And there aren't a lot, right? So, for example, in that article, just go on that tangent for a second, the only example that you actually get in that article, it's called The Cool Kids Philosopher, about Ben Shapiro, of him destroying a weak argument, is he's at a Q&A on a college campus, and this 22-year-old girl is challenging him in the Q&A about his position on trans rights, and he says, "Hey, how old are you?" And she says, "Oh, I'm 22." And he says, "Oh, could you just identify as being 60? And she's flustered for a second, and then he kind of bulldozes over her and talks over her and makes his point. And so if this is like what you do, right, you know, you're the destroyer of weak arguments, and the standout example is that you like momentarily flustered a 22-year-old so she wasn't quite sure what to say about your silly analogy,
right,
then that doesn't really seem like you're backing up the claim, which is one of the reasons I think it is important to detoxify this language, because right now a lot of people on the right get a lot of mileage just out of saying the words, right? You know, they use these almost like magic incantations, facts and logic, fact, you know, yeah, exactly. So, you know, logic, facts, and evidence. Even though oftentimes they're very confused about like what these words even mean. Very often the sort of people that you run into, anybody who's ever argued about politics a lot on social media, has run into your kind of basement dwelling libertarian trolls who love to throw around accusations of logical fallacies, and they love to do it in like this really rapid fire way, right? Like that's what's really impressive for them, that they can do the instant diagnosis of what's wrong with your argument. Now, when I talk about reclaiming logic for the left, that means two things. One of them is showing what's wrong with these right-wing arguments, and oftentimes they are actually very bad arguments because they can coast by because so few people push back on them, in the way, you know, at least in the ways that I'm suggesting that they should, and, you know, that we make more explicit arguments for our positions, but also reclaiming the way of doing logic. Because if you're just kind of listening to what somebody says and coming up with this snap judgment about what's wrong with it, then you aren't really carefully thinking about it. And so if the point of these tools, right, the kinds of things, you know, you mentioned that I would teach in a class like a logic, reasoning, and persuasion class at Rutgers. If the point of these tools is to just be like a way of scoring points, you know, and, you know, making, you know, making yourself look impressive to, you know, your fellow trolls and making people feel flustered or unsure what to say, then sure, that's a good way of doing it. But if the purpose of these tools is to reason better so you're more likely to get things right, then that's exactly the wrong way to do it.
Well, let's – okay, and then you also have this critique, which I think – I mean, a lot of us fall into in various ways. But I think it's true that, like, both snark and moral condemnation are totally valid modes of communication, but they can't be the only modes. And the left has kind of fallen into a sort of over-reliance on those two tactics, which I agree – I've been persuaded by you. So then let's go back to the Ben Shapiro example, because my impulse when I read that is to make fun of his voice and just call him a transphobic twerp and move on. Explain why that analogy is bad. Why is actually the tactic that he used to fluster that woman, why is that actually not rigorous argumentation?
Yeah, so when you talk about gender and gender identity, like the small part that he's right about is that one internally consistent ways to use words like man, woman, gender, etc. is to mean, like, to use the word woman to mean anybody who's chromosomally female and is an adult human, and, you know, use the word man to mean biologically male adult human. And that's one internally consistent way of using those words. But of course, it's not the only internally consistent way of using those words. That, you know, we can, you know, because obviously there are people who use them consistently and coherently in this other way to talk about gender identity and gender expression. Right. And, you know, an analogy that I find really useful that's not original to me, but comes from a trans woman who is a philosophy professor, Sophie Grace Chappelle. At least that's what I've seen it, is to adoptive parents. So one internally consistent way of using the word parent is to exclusively refer to something biological. Mm-hmm. That, so, you know, or words like mother or father, you know, that's the sense in which we use these words in a sentence, like the DNA test came, you know, came back and you're not the father. But
sorry.
As I'm sure you've heard many times before, you know, to your great relief.
Okay.
But like, clearly another consistent way of using these words is to refer to somebody who has the legal or social role of a parent. And you can insist on just using it in your preferred way. Like, you know, we can imagine, some bizarrely bigoted school principal who refused to allow adoptive parents to participate in parent-teacher conferences because, because parent has a biological definition and that's just what the word means.
Right.
Facts don't care about your feelings.
Right.
But, you know, clearly there's nothing about the biological facts or logical consistency that dictates that choice. Now, it's a lot less obvious in the case of age that there's an internally consistent way of using words like 60 or 22 that's not tied to chronology in the same way. There might be. Some people make that argument, but I don't think we can just assume that, right? That they have, and there are certainly some obvious disanalogies, like many trans people, not all of them, but many trans people will talk about having, you know, like if somebody is a trans woman, they might talk about having always known they were a woman. And I'm not sure that it's coherent to say that you always knew you were 60 years old, right? It seems like part of what's built into being 60 is that before that you were 59 or you were 58. And just to tie this into what you said before that, it seems to me that, look, you know me pretty well at this point. I'm not anti-mockery, right? I am serially guilty of mocking people. And there are certainly things in the world that deserve moral condemnation. But the reason not to just respond to the Ben Shapiros of the world with those tools is, one, then when he makes a ridiculous, spurious argument, like this thing about gender identity and age, if you only respond by, you know, saying that he's a bigot, and, you know, making fun of his ridiculous voice and all of that, then you have left anybody who's not sure what to think with the impression that we don't actually have a response, that this is such a knockdown argument that, you know, like if we never get around to saying what's wrong with the argument, then people will understandably get the impression that we don't actually have a good response to that argument, and we're going to lose winnable people. And then the other problem is that if mockery and moral condemnation are our only tools, then when legitimate tactical, strategic, or policy differences come up on the left, those are the tools that we're going to turn on each other. And that gets very ugly. That gets very alienating. I think a lot of regular people, very understandably, want absolutely nothing to do with left-wing spaces that are like that internally.
Right, totally, of course. No, they're super toxic and repulsive. And I think, yeah, and people need to understand when there is actually like a real legitimate range of even really vigorous disagreement, you know, inside contexts where there actually are legitimate sort of shared political goals and orientations. And I just want to use briefly, like, this isn't just in the sort of like, you know, okay, like, yes, left-wing Twitter is toxic, whatever, like all Twitter is. But this is also like there's many factors. But one of the reasons that, you know, Podemos, the left-wing party in Spain, recently underperformed was because, I mean, there was actually Spanish police units trying to undermine them in a very disturbing case of political sabotage. So that's a very important thing to cover. But there also was just, and, you know, Nando Vila talks about this, just the sort of typical, almost sort of stereotypical sort of like breakdown of internal left cohesion inside the party and like serious, you know, really, really ugly and in some cases clearly unnecessary infighting that undermined significantly their electoral prospects for, you know, basically advocating some form of genuine democratic and socialist politics in Spain. It matters a lot. Can you then get us into the other big problem? There's disanalogies. Then there's also the is-ought distinction. This is something obviously that comes up with a lot in the problems and sloppiness of someone like Sam Harris's thinking. But it also gets, I think, really importantly though, because this in a way sort of weaves some of the broader objections that come up. Like, no, of course we can't just, you know, we do need to have other commitments in our reasoning, including like, you know, ethical ones.
Yeah, absolutely. The IDW, who you're writing a book about, all of these guys are guilty of making massive logical leaps about this subject, right? You know, I mean, certainly the main, you know, the core villains, you know, Peterson, Harris, Shapiro, all in their own way do this, right? So when Ben Shapiro says that facts don't care about your feelings, his implication is that the right gets its policy prescriptions from facts, and the left gets it from, you know, the way we feel. And this is a very common idea on the right in general. And this is particularly something that all of these guys in the IDW have, you know, like just routinely have problems with. So this is a distinction that's made by the great Enlightenment philosopher from Scotland, David Hume, who talks about the distinction between facts and values, is and ought. And so this is something that logicians sometimes refer to as Hume's law. It's an actual law of logic that says basically that in order for an argument to be valid, in order for the conclusion to follow from the premises, if the conclusion is about right or wrong, good or bad, what we should do, then there has to be a premise like that too, right? You can't go straight from some factual claim to a claim about what we should do. There's always some kind of any kind of inference like that. There's always some kind of implied value premise, mm-hmm. right? And this is something that these guys don't like to talk about, right? You know, they like to say, you know, if, for example, right, you know, Ben Shapiro is talking about how, you know, tough, you know, criminal sentencing laws supposedly reduce the crime rate. And, you know, the only reason that people now see, you know, like even Joe Biden now sees the need to run away from this is that, you know, support for getting tough on this is now no longer considered woke, right? He just had an article in the Daily Wire making this claim. Well, you can't go straight from, even if it's true, it's actually an incredibly dubious factual claim, but even if it's true, the causal claim that he's making, nothing follows about whether or not you should actually have these tougher criminal sentencing laws, because there's also this evaluative component, right? Is the only thing that we care about lower crime rates? Do we also care about the rights of criminal defendants, do we care about civil liberties issues that might be raised by this? And Sam Harris, as you mentioned, is particularly bad on this because Harris will actually claim that his moral beliefs can be directly derived from science, which is just total nonsense, right? Science, you know, facts in general can tell us how to get to the goals we care about, right? Once we decide what we care about, then, of course, all kinds of factual information can be relevant to how that we can best, most efficiently achieve those goals, right? You know, we want to care, you know, we want to close the racial wealth gap. Should we just be looking at redistributive social programs that are universalist but that disproportionately benefit minorities? Or should we also be advocating reparations if we have real-world examples we could point to where either of these policies were tried? Then, of course, that could be relevant to that argument. But first, we have to actually have the goal of closing the racial wealth gap, right? So what the facts can tell us is how to achieve the goals we care about. The facts can't tell us which goals to care about in the first place. Right. And even though the people who pretend that they can make this huge deal about the rhetoric of logic, you know, logic and facts and logic, facts and evidence, this is actually a logical principle that you actually can't do that.
And so how does that actually intersect then with, you know, because we joked, I mean, Matt and I have a bit about how we're going to create the first purely emotionally driven artificial intelligence. It's the the left wing robot that cares nothing for facts and logics. It's just emotions, period. But, you know, my understanding too, and I wonder if this does, like, if some of the kind of potentially, you know, neuroscience of people like Antonio Damasio maybe potentially reflects Hume, just in the sense that, can you even make these hard and fast distinctions between logic and emotion, right? Like that sort of, like, to me, like, you know, even outside of these political subcultures, there's, I guess, the, you know, like the kind of like pop culture Star Trek ideal of, well, you know, there's Spock can think perfectly logically and emotion does not interfere. But it seems like that, as far as we understand in terms of how people actually work as human systems, the emotional and logic components are not as divided or as separable as, you know, somebody might make it in a thought experiment.
Yeah, well, look, I've always said Star Trek has a lot to answer for, because it's given generations of television viewers the idea that logic and emotion are somehow in conflict, which they're not. Right? So it's, of course, it's possible to be so upset that you can't think straight.
Right.
Right? That's obviously, you know, in the moment, right? That's obviously possible. And of course, there are lots of reasons, you know, why there are situations in which it's important to calm down so you can think strategically right. about how to achieve the goals that you care about. But that doesn't mean that you stop caring about those goals in the first place. That doesn't mean that you're no longer emotionally invested in the pursuit of justice or equality or, you know, any of these things. Because if you didn't care about those things in the first place, you know, you wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't be engaged in this reasoning. And of course, it's not that, you know, it's not that you just turn off one part of, you know, one part of your mind while you're doing, you know, while you're reasoning. Even if that were possible, I don't know that that would be desirable. You know, that's really not the, you know, not the point at all, right? You know, you can care very passionately and appropriately about correcting injustice and also think very clearly about how to get there.
Right. Now, but does this, though, at some point, whether we like it or not, loop back to, you know, and I've brought this up with you before, I like the Carol Gilligan example that she did, you know, her work on spheres of care, right? And just to, you know, mm-hmm. simplify it, that basically the scent, and she has a lot of other, you know, again, there's a lot more to her work. She's a brilliant psychologist. But the one simple thing I'll extract for this conversation is like self-care, community care, world care. And those sort of like realms of moral imagination sort of correlate with different levels of psychic, you know, at least capacity to empathize, capacity to, you know, again, just expand your sphere of concern. And it just seems to me like, yes, of course, you know, there's argumentation, there's serious, there's political difference, there's, you know, all of the, but there is this, like, I don't know what the difference between somebody who, you know, sees like a homeless encampment in LA or walks by people in sub-freezing degrees in New York and then, you know, recognizes that there's hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, penthouses, you know, billions of dollars of real estate that isn't even used and just registers that that's just absolutely morally revolting versus somebody mm-hmm. who either, you know, doesn't notice it or maybe, you know, in the Randian sense has sort of built some type of like, you know, bizarre, horrifying, dystopian counter scenario where that's actually really healthy and really just. You know, to me, those are expressing different baselines upon which you start an analysis. I don't know. I mean, is that escapable? I mean, again, not that people can't be persuaded, but isn't that the part of it where it's like, I don't want to say they're right because it isn't like a feeling, but it's like you come to things with, you know, a particular sets of convictions really broadly defined. And part of that is going to be, you know, how you relate to that example of like the homeless people versus the unused real estate.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. So absolutely, it is true that, you know, that what you start with is that you care about certain outcomes that, you know, that, or, you know, you're bothered by certain realities. So, you know, so you want to correct them. But of course, the important thing to emphasize here, is that that's just as true for the right as for the left.
Right.
Right? You know, it's not that, mm-hmm. It's not that like we care about certain, you know, certain outcomes and our politics are driven by that. But they're somehow, you know, being driven by, you know, by facts, you know, by, you know, in that ridiculous Sam Harris extreme, you know, that they're extrapolating their values from science somehow, which is logically impossible anyway. So that's not it, right? they also have goals that they care about, right? You know, that they have that, like, one of the things that might drive you to that Ayn Rand kind of view is, well, okay, for example, if you are actually Ayn Rand, then I think the fact that, you know, that she came from, I think, a fairly well-off family in Russia who had their stuff taken away by the Bolsheviks, you know, or certainly at least, you know, I don't know that much about her family background, but, you know, that she saw this happening and she thought that was morally outrageous, right? You know, like that this is something that's very, that's like libertarians often tend to come to their politics from a starting point of clearly, you know, it's outrageous, it's unjust, you know, it makes me angry that anybody might try to take my stuff, or even that anybody might try to take anybody's stuff, right? You know, that, like, you know, even if you're, you know, even if you're like the libertarian who, you know, has a working class job, but, you know, has dreams, Horatio Alger dreams or whatever.
Right.
So in, you know, and then they sort of say, okay, well, they have this moral intuition that that's bad. And then they build, you know, and then they start reasoning about it, right? And that's not even a criticism, right? Like, I think that they have bizarre alien moral intuitions, you know, from my perspective, you know, that that taking, you know, expropriating property so we don't have a society where some people live under bridges and some, you know, nice buildings are remain vacant, you know, because, you know, Russian oligarchs are just using them to park their money, you know, that that expropriation to fix that would obviously, you know, would clearly be just. But it's inescapable that you start off with some moral intuitions, that you start off with some goals that you care about before you can even start to reason about how to achieve those goals. Now, the people who feel absolutely nothing about that scenario that you're describing, you know, the combination of penthouses and homelessness, those are people I'm under no illusions that we can win over, right? We're not going to. And, you know, I'm a socialist. I think that generally speaking, most people who are certainly in the 1%, right, you know, let's just go there, are, with some exceptions, right, but most people who are in that position are going to rationalize the justice of it to themselves, and nothing we say is going to convince them, right? You know, there's no moral argument we can give to Jeff Bezos that will lead to him correcting the conditions in Amazon warehouses. You have to fight for that. But the process of fighting for that involves winning over a lot of people who aren't currently leftists, and so some of those people might even be currently swayed, you know, even in complicated centrist ways or just, you know, complicated ways, like, you know, the sort of guy on the street who doesn't watch the Majority Report, whose three favorite politicians are Bernie Sanders, you know, Joe Biden and Ron Paul.
Right.
You know, and there's just no, you know, like, but in complicated ways, people do think, you know, they do share some of our moral intuitions, but they're also somewhat taken in by some of the stuff that the other side says, right? You know, they do think that there's something that is screwed up about the combination of penthouses and homelessness. You know, they're not immune from feeling that, but they sort of, you know, they because they've heard it so much, they sort of think, oh, that wouldn't be okay to take away people's stuff in order to correct it. And so those are the people I think that you can win. You can't win all of them, but, you know, the more of them we can win over, the more successful we're going to be. And that involves, yeah, making arguments, but some of those arguments are going to be appealing to their underlying values, you know, like that, hey, you agree that this is really bad, right? Well, you know, which of these is more important to you, that, you know, Jeff Bezos gets to keep his fortune, or that, like, everybody, you know, everybody can go to the doctor, you know, anytime they want to, right?
Right.
And
you should trust your moral intuition of the obvious answer to that question.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
And, you know, and I think that sometimes when people on the right do give sophistical arguments that you shouldn't, right, trust that, if all we're doing is saying they're bad, they have really, you know, whiny nasal voices, they're bad, then I don't think we're using all of the weapons in our arsenal to counter that, right? You know, if people, if you can, sometimes if you can show people, yeah, the reasons they're giving you for thinking that we have to accept this actually don't make sense, even on their own terms, you can kind of break it apart. That doesn't mean that, like, everybody is going to be magically convinced, but, you know, by what you just said, like the reaction, you know, in an Aaron Sorkin TV show to a stirring speech. But it does, you know, but it will get some people thinking, and some of the people who are winnable can be won over that way. And certainly if we don't try to show what's wrong with their specious arguments, then we're preemptively surrendering, I think, at a front where we really don't need to surrender.
I agree with you completely. I just, in the last couple of minutes, and this I will say, I mean, obviously, in some ways, this is the sort of center of my book and a much broader, I mean, using the IDW in some ways as a case study to both advocate for a certain kind of synthesis of cosmopolitanism and socialism, globalism and socialism that I care a lot about, but then also more broadly that, you know, and this is, I don't remember where this quote originated at the moment, but essentially, and plenty of people have made this point, but the distinction between the right as a naturalizing project and the left as a historicizing project. And this is the way in which, by the way, even people who take that very kind of, like, you know, internet quiz view of politics where they'll say, like, oh, no, like somebody like, you know, Sam Harris is really, you know, center left because, I don't know, I have some quote somewhere where he supported some progressive taxation or something like this. Whereas my argument is that, no, like, all of these figures are fundamentally on the right. And to me, a big part of just fundamentally being on the right, even if your politics are, you know, I don't know, say, you know, wind up being some version of like a Clintonian Democrat or something, is if your fundamental starting point is that, whether it's scientific or religious or mythological, that there are sort of like just these innate truths of things that can't be, you know, altered. Now, obviously, some things do have innate truths of things that can't be altered, and we're not advocating like a blank slate view of people, of course. But on the other hand, like, no, there's nothing that's set in stone.
That's not the plan, that majority report year one?
No. Oh, well, I mean, yes. That's more TMBS year one. Okay. But, I mean, that's not a blank slate view. That's just a year one view. But that's another conversation. But, you know, but that, you know, there's nothing organic or innate about an extreme income inequality or anything like that. Or really, you know, that, and by the way, that's another disanalogy, right? Like, no, is everybody going to have the same height or ability to, like, play basketball well or tennis well? No. Does that get transferred to, therefore, some people are going to have billions of dollars of assets and other people starve? No. That's actually a really ludicrous, horrifying disanalogy. But that being said, you know, and I sort of center it in the exchange that, you know, when Sam Harris was really going to bat for the bell curve and advocating what I would certainly deem to be both within the field, but also more broadly, you know, discredited and racist IQ stuff, he, in his debate with Ezra Klein, and Ezra Klein, of all people, is saying, look, I mean, historically, we have a lot of examples of basically European guys sitting down and saying, you know, we've devised a quote unquote objective system that shows that we're the best. Like, who would have thunk it? And Harris, I'll paraphrase, you know, he got, you know, got very triggered and basically said the history was, I believe the word was, irrelevant, if I recall correctly. And, you know, to me, I can't think of anything, including a lot of, you know, actually really bad, like, neoliberal and woke takes I don't like, where I don't think the history is anything other than probably the most relevant. So where does that kind of, you know, not allowing them to also not only misuse logic, but use logic as like, no, we're never going to talk about anything real. We're only going to do sort of like extended mind games with each other. So we're never going to actually talk. Like, we'll do sort of like our read of popular science and economics, maybe, and then a bunch of imaginative exercises. But we're going to leave, ironically, the entire empirical playing field almost always You know, Shapiro's different. Shapiro obviously kind of gives more of the sort of 1950s kind of view of history. But in general, that, you know, that comment, the history is irrelevant to historical inquiry or unimportant to logical exchange. What's the answer to that, to bring history and context to logic and facts?
Yeah, so I'd say that a lot of that is just a category mistake that, you know, people, a lot of the people who most valorize logic on the right give you the impression that caring a lot about logic means that you try to like derive everything from like three first principles. But of course, that there's absolutely nothing about caring about good reasoning that dictates that attitude. And in fact, I would argue that caring about good reasoning should be that you don't go there, right? Because oftentimes there is going to be a clear logical relationship between some, you know, political claim, some, you know, like some attempt to apply a moral principle to politics and historical facts, sociological facts. And a historical argument is an argument. A sociological argument is an argument. If you want to reason well, if the goal of reasoning is to figure out the truth, then you should be looking at anything that might be relevant to help and figure it out. And it's often very revealing because, just to pick an obvious example of a case where the history is very relevant, right? We were talking earlier about libertarians who think that it's just wrong in principle to take away any of, you know, like Jeff Bezos has a moral right to every cent in his bank account, and, you know, and it's just stealing if you take any of it away for, you know, redistributive programs, for example. And that, you know, then you sort of interrogate them a little bit. And you say, well, okay, but why, right? And of course, they can't say because the ideal way that a society should be, right, the thing that we should really hope to end up at is some people have billions of dollars and can talk to their senator anytime they want to, and some people are working all day in the warehouse if they're even lucky enough to have a job,
right?
Because even they wouldn't say that, like, that's the ideal end state that we would aim at. So what they end up saying is that, well, we should as long as things came about in the right way, right? As long as you weren't violating anybody's rights, it all came about through a free market, what the libertarian philosopher Robert Nozick calls capitalistic acts between consenting adults, then no matter how unequal the outcome is, it's okay. But then, of course, the obvious response is, but wait a second, that's not what happened, right? Like, even in Europe, capitalism emerged from feudalism, and, you know, with this massive process of enclosure and people being forced off their lands, they had to work in factories. And that's pretty cozy and consensual compared to what happened in the New World, where capitalism was literally built up by the labor of slaves on land stolen from genocide victims. And strangely enough, though, a lot of the same people who will use this kind of libertarian argument, whatever end state you end up with is cool as long as it comes out in the right way, suddenly go all Sam Harris, the history is irrelevant when you start bringing up how it actually came about.
Right. 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 Or, you know, again, not to bring up another example, but I remember, you know, you in an exchange with, I don't remember, some YouTube channel kind of saying, like, well, actually, you know, Richard Wolff, as an example, his ideas of workplace democracy, we actually have a lot of examples of co-op models being very effective, whether we're talking about Madrigon in Spain or Cleveland in Ohio. And the guy you were debating sort of went from like saying like, well, that's just the most ridiculous idea in the world that you could have a bottom up workplace to, oh, okay, all right. I don't, please, enough with the examples of actual things happening. Yeah, I would like to get back to my assertion.
The phrase was let's not get into the weeds.
Yeah, no, last place you'd want to get. certainly, yeah, right. Again, ironically, for like the whole empiricism gang. So ironically, I guess I leave these conversations I usually do with you with the sort of horrifying realization that I'm a nerd. So I like to actually talk about real shit.
Keep wearing the tracksuits. It disguises it well.
Thank you very much. I shall. Penn Burgess, the book is Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. It's available on pre-order from Zero Books. It's an excellent book. And obviously, go check out his books on the his videos on the Zero Books channel. You can hear him on TMBS. He's actually going to be the guest on TMBS this coming Tuesday. You can also hear him. You're going to be on Ralph Nader's podcast, right?
Yeah, I don't know when the podcast actually airs. I think it's a pre-record, but I'm going to record that on May 29th, so just before the book comes out.
Awesome, and you're on a lot with the great David Feldman. Everybody check out David Feldman's podcast. I love that podcast.
Ben, is there going to be an audiobook?
I hope so. I have talked with Doug, our editor at Zero Books, about that. And he wants to do it. It's not planned yet. There's going to be a paper book and an e-book on the 31st, and I hope at some point thereafter there's going to be an audiobook.
Cool.
Yeah, that's the only way Matt's going to read it.
No, I might buy the Kindle version.
I have the actual paperback book, and it's also the cover art of David Hume in a powdered wig shushing Ben Shapiro is one of the funniest things I've seen in quite some time. It's extremely good.
Shout out to Ryan Lake, who is a philosophy professor at Georgia State, and he's also a regular philosophy themed webcomic called Chaos Pet, who's the person who drew that cover art.
Well, it's a great work. And I'd also just like to say, in the spirit of this more expansive kind of wrapping up, Ben and others like him are another prime reason why the capitalist classes want to completely drain all funding from any type of humanities or social science in public education, because kids should terrorized to work in a factory, or if they have any talent, you know, like producing weapons.
Oh yeah, critical thinking not needed for the economy of the future.
Not good. Don't like.
Well,
that.
I'm sure you saw Bolsonaro wants to cut off all state funding to philosophy and sociology departments in Brazil.
Yep, I sure did.
Got to protect Western civilization.
Got to protect Western civilization for people who can think. Ben Burgess, everybody order the book, Give Them an Argument, Logic for the Left. Ben, thanks so much.
All right, thanks so much for having me on.
Appreciate it. Seriously, guys, it's a really great book. And I would check out on TMBS YouTube channel all the debunk segments. They're very fun. We use specific quotes from everybody from Jordan Peterson to Nancy Pelosi, and Ben will explain why they're not being logical.
Sounds good.
In a friendly and inviting way, though. Not in a...
fallacy.
Right.
In a slightly less mocking way than we typically do, although that's usually there, too.
Well, usually Ben sort of does a great job, and then he's kind of like, hey, can I mock everybody now?
He earned it.
Oh, yeah.
You have to earn it.
Yeah, you earn the mockery. Yeah. Then it's like, now it's time for the ad-homs.
It's all about different. I mean, all approaches are good. I think just going direct to mockery when you have an audience that basically knows, you know, Ben Shapiro's and Sam Harris, they're racists. It
Meghan
works.
McCain
and it's
is
fun.
A monster.
And then, you know, people,
and your opinions.
These are opinions, yeah. Opinions, I mean, they're not literally a monster.
Our opinions matter.
Who knows? Who knows? Maybe these are factual statements.
Yeah, I definitely don't know. Opinions can be facts. This is a fluid world. I have no idea.
But it's nice to, you know, for the people who might want to, you know, see it taken at face value for at least a moment, be like, can we actually deconstruct this?
Can we deconstruct and then have some fun? Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. That's how we pay the bills. That's how we give you this great content, justcoffee.coop. Fair trade tea, coffee, or a chocolate, a win for us, a win for labor, a win for the environment, a win for the co-op economy. It's great stuff. It's an amazing company to be associated with. Spread the word. That's how the Majority Report happens. On Tuesday on the Michael Brooks Show, we had the great Anna Kasparian. That was awesome. We had an incredible time in the main show and the postgame for patrons. Also, Dr. Maitha Al-Hassan joined us. She was brilliant, talking about Algeria, Sudan, Malcolm X. She also requested that she be on a TMBS Sam Harris tribunal, which Ben Burgess also
so
would
she
like
knows,
to be on.
She's very sort of in tune with the poetry of the show.
She is very in tune. When she suggested the joke started because Malcolm X suggested that actually Islam could be really good for white people. And I said, I don't really...
I know somebody else with that take too, but never mind.
That's my Well, actually, all kidding aside, I don't really advocate religion, but I advocate Islam for Sam Harris, and that led to a lot of an expansive exploration of ideas.
He reads the Quran the same way fundamentalists do.
Right.
So.
Yeah,
he seems like a lost soul.
Maybe I don't want him to become a Muslim, because if he reads like that, it could be very bad. Not Sufi.
Muslims are like, we don't want him on our team.
That's okay. Then there's an illicit history of humanitarian law and the ICC in Africa with Kristen Pierre Anderson this weekend. Patreon.com/TMBS. Go to the Majority Report YouTube channel and subscribe. And new next live show going to be announced pretty soon. Jamie, not only what's going on with the Antifada and also what's going on. One, at the end of this month in May, you need to register to vote if you're in New York. You must do that. If you're not registered to vote by the end of May, you cannot vote in the Democratic primary. You cannot register, your opinion.
Yeah. You need to register as a Democrat if you want to vote in the Democratic primary, because it's a closed primary.
And speaking from somebody who had to register to vote in New York after North Dakota didn't have voter registration when I lived there. The first time, they might get you a weird rejection. I got a weird rejection the first time I did. So get it in early so you get the confirmation.
Get it in early, get the confirmation. Be very aggressive with them and make sure that they have all your right information, because you obviously, if you're a New Yorker or anybody, you don't want to be missing out on voting. And New York still has incredibly ridiculous and antiquated and horrible voting laws, and it should be automatic same-day registration. But anyways, that's another conversation.
But the primaries are fun to vote in, and you can have a good effect.
They are. And by the way, obviously we've got this huge presidential race coming up, but there's a whole bunch of, you know how satisfying it was to knock out a IDC right-wing guy and replace him with like a good progressive
who
helped fight the Amazon deal?
Myrie, what's his?
Zellner Myrie.
Zellner Myrie, yeah.
Zellner Myrie, really, he's really good.
Good dude.
So so it matters on all sorts of levels. Or even when you come up short, it was awesome to campaign for Jabari Bridgeport as an example for city council. All right. Sorry about that. Jamie, tell us about the show, but also there's the DSA thing too, right?
Indeed.
Okay.
This week on the Antifada, we're a little late posting the episode because my husband screwed up the sound recording, but it's coming out later today. We have... Indeed. We have a roundtable with noted BreadTube content creators Non-Compete, The Serfs, and Means TV.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I was away at the Drone Festival over the weekend. So this is all Sean. I'll read what he wrote. We discuss the sociological and structural reasons why the alt-right has gained near hegemony over YouTube and other platforms, and what anti-capitalist content creators are doing to fight back. The Serfs give a cautionary tale about being deplatformed by a coordinated right-wing attack, and how tons of people, including the Majority Report family, helped pressure Google into giving them back their channel. Lastly, special guest Nick presents the vision behind Means Media, which aims to build a collectively owned and operated left media cooperative as an alternative platform that will help seize the means from our corporate media overlords.
Very cool.
So they're the ones who did that very viral ad for AOC.
Yep, and they also did another. I want to always give honorable mention, because even though unfortunately it didn't work out for him, but they also, their ad for Kaniela Ng, who ran in Hawaii, was amazing.
Yeah. They do
really good work, and we love the Serfs. We love the Serfs.
Yeah, and it's very much like all different kinds of leftists on this channel. It's a very pan-leftist operation. So everyone from DSA people, AOC types, to anarchists and communists and everybody.
Awesome.
Yeah. Oh, and also, I'm glad you reminded me.
Yes.
We are having a fundraiser party for the North Brooklyn DSA this weekend. I'm going to put a link to the tickets in the blog post that I'm going to write after the show. You don't have to come to buy a ticket. So if you don't live here, you can still support the work we're doing. But it's going to be super fun. I hope some of you guys can come and hang out and dance and have a good time. We have a live band. We have a communist drag queen named Comrade Barbie.
Nice.
It's going to be amazing.
Sam and I might stop by.
That would be very nice.
Like as a team?
Probably not as a team. No. Oh.
Are you separately. His wingman now?
Yeah. They go everywhere together.
Yeah, that, Matt.
It's like, hi.
You see them walking through Brooklyn.
Hello. Can I engage you in an argument? Do you see?
He'd be a real hit.
Matt?
Yeah, Literary Hangover, the most recent thing published, is just for patrons. But if you want to know why Orwell was very skeptical of the popular front, basically his dividing line comes to, he goes to Spain for the Spanish Civil Wars, fighting with the anarchists and the Trotskyists, specifically in Catalonia. And he sort of buys the idea that you might want to stop the revolution a little bit to, you know, fight the war. But his problem comes when the revolutionary gains are being reversed. And I think actually that's sort of a good approach to take to popular fronts in general, that not a single thing is done on behalf of capital in that time of popular front. Otherwise, you call it off because it's basically just a handmaiden to fascism at that point.
Absolutely. I love it. All right. I'm not sure. I just want to do a heads up. I know people get very intense about the IMs, but it's not opening. So we'll see if we can deal with that. But we will see you in the fun half.